off. The breastfeeding support group occurred in a room accessed by a curtained-off doorway at the rear of the boutique. Despite the swankiness of the boutique's merchandise, this room was filled with furniture whose best days had come and gone. Three mismatched, stained couches and a handful of chairs formed a lopsided circle. Scattered about were those C-shaped pillows I had believed until shortly before Sadie's birth were meant to alleviate the discomfort of hemorrhoids, but now knew were platforms for nursing babies. When I entered the room, 11 or 12 other women, all with infants, were chatting, about half of them with their breasts fully or partially displayed. Instead of being differentiated by their personalities, the women were differentiated by their nipples. I'd carried Sadie inside in her car seat, and I set it on the floor behind an empty chair, along with her diaper bag, and lifted her out. Mother-baby duos continued to trickle in as the support group's leader, a gorgeous and slender woman wearing a crocheted turquoise sundress, got things rolling. "I'm Nico," she said. "I'm the mom of Scarlett, who's 6 and has self-weaned, and Declan, who's 4 and loves breastfeeding. I'm passionate about helping moms like you give this beautiful, natural, and super healthy gift to your little ones." As with prenatal yoga, we were then supposed to go around and introduce ourselves. Gretchen went third, and after she'd said her name, she said, "And this is Piper, who was born via C-section after a grueling 26 hours of labor. I was like, 'No drugs, no drugs!' And Carl was like, 'Gretchen, seriously, you're superwoman.' But then there was an umbilical cord prolapse, so it was out of my hands. On the upside, Piper's nursing like a champ." "If your delivery didn't happen how you wanted, it's important to grieve," Nico said. "At the same time, don't underestimate how amazing it is that now you're literally sustaining her with your own body." The next person who introduced herself was named Jessica. Her baby was Ethan, and both of them began to cry as Jessica described how challenging Ethan's tongue tie made breastfeeding, which caused me to perk up with interest. Introductions were then stalled for 20 minutes as other mothers murmured support and a discussion of positions occurred. Nico was soon on her knees crouched over Jessica, maneuvering Jessica's left breast, though she looked around at all of us as she said, "Breastfeeding shouldn't hurt. We wouldn't have survived as a species if it did, right? So if you're in pain, what it probably means is that you have a bad latch." Introductions never did get all the way around the circle, and the hour was finished. It concluded with Nico reading aloud a poem that rhymed lactation and revelation before I'd said my own or Sadie's name. I set my daughter back in her car seat, hoisted the diaper bag onto my shoulder, took all of us out to the car, and drove home, stopping on the way to purchase a 1.45-pound container of powdered formula. Fixing Sadie a bottle that afternoon felt at first like a transgression, and then, as she accepted it unfussily, like a relief. I planned to alternate between formula and breast milk, but within a week, I'd stopped nursing altogether and was using my employee coupons to buy formula in bulk. Needless to say, I didn't return to the support group. The third place I crossed paths with Gretchen was at infant swim lessons. By that point, Sadie was 6 months old. The lessons occurred on Tuesday mornings, which was the day I worked from home, though my original plan to get things done while Sadie napped had been delusional and I'd basically given up on it. To seem productive, I sent frequent emails to my coworkers. Only 5 babies were enrolled in the swim class, but if Gretchen recognized me, she gave no sign of it. A strange intimacy existed between us as we stood in the water next to each other in our tank bathing suits or took turns holding our babies in the center of the circle while singing, "Purple potatoes and purple tomatoes and Sadie is in the stew." Yet Gretchen and I never spoke to each other directly. Piper seemed good-natured, and I assumed that she was still nursing like a champ and that Gretchen was greatly enjoying not outsourcing her childcare. Then, around the fourth class, Gretchen and Piper stopped showing up. The weird part was that I almost missed them. Without the tension created by my antipathy toward Gretchen, the half hour felt slack, and I realized for the first time that I found the swim lessons boring. Another 3 months passed, during which my company laid off 1,200 employees, including my boss and five other people in my department. My new boss was a 26-year-old guy with an MBA. That is, he was 3 years younger than I was. And he told me that if I wanted to keep my job, I needed to work full-time and on-site. The next day, my mother-in-law, who'd been walking with a limp for 2 years, was approved by her orthopedist to have her hip replaced. Her recovery would last 4 to 6 weeks, and taking care of Sadie during that time was out of the question. It wasn't that I looked down on parents who put their kids in daycare. It wasn't that I disapproved of them. Or at least if I did disapprove, I knew enough to be embarrassed by my disapproval. I wasn't a person compelled to broadcast my own choices in the hopes of making other people feel inferior. Nevertheless, on Sadie's first day at Green Valley Children's Center, I didn't even make it out the front door before I burst into tears. I hadn't felt that bad about some of the things that women having babies when I did, even in Omaha, were supposed to feel bad about. An epidural? Formula? But the collapse of my carefully crafted childcare setup seemed like a failure of a different magnitude. Although Adam and I had planned to bring Sadie to daycare together, a last-minute meeting had been scheduled at his office. So I was alone. Blinded by tears, I pushed open the front door of the center and stood in the parking lot, sobbing. I needed to get to my car, to hide, but I was so flustered that I couldn't remember where I'd parked. And then someone's arms were around me. The someone was female, and her shampoo smelled like coconut. And she was saying, "It's your first day, right? I saw you doing drop-off upstairs. But don't worry, because seriously, Green Valley is great. I was nervous, too, but now I love it so much." It took several seconds of collecting myself, and then of focusing on the woman's face. She was still embracing me, and we were almost too close together for me to see her, to realize that the woman was Gretchen. I think she understood that I was recognizing her. Perhaps I flinched, and she dropped her arms. She said, "I don't know if you remember me, but we were in the same, I remember you." I wiped my nose with my left palm. "I thought you were a stay-at-home mom." She laughed. "Well, Carl left me in March, which kind of threw a wrench into things." Then she said, "It turns out my husband was having an affair since before I got pregnant, and now I'm single and working full-time. Life is full of surprises, huh?" I was taken aback and said nothing, and she added, "Really, though, I've been so happy with this place. I've learned a ton from the teachers." It was early July, almost a full year since Gretchen and I had met. Although, in a way, we'd never met. Neither of our daughters had celebrated their first birthdays yet. And when I look back, our girls are 8 now, I'm struck by how that was still the beginning of them becoming themselves, and of us becoming mothers. In the years since, Sadie and Piper have learned to tie their shoes and ride bikes and read. They've had croup and stomach flu. Their feelings have been hurt. They've lost teeth. They've performed in ballet recitals. I don't know if it's more improbable that Gretchen and I became each other's closest friends, or that our daughters did, too. Not that it's all been easy for any of us. I had 2 miscarriages before the birth of my son, and Gretchen got engaged again, but subsequently called it off. Sometimes, when I see photos Adam took of me holding Sadie in the first month of her life, I can discern the faintly bumpy outline of cabbage leaves beneath my nursing bra, and I'm reminded of a particular kind of confusion that hasn't entirely disappeared but has, with time, decreased. That morning in the parking lot, I sniffled once more, then extended my hand to Gretchen. "Hi," I said. "I'm Rachel."
Plausible deniability. "Stop me if I've told you this," my brother says. Libby read an article about how when you flush the toilet, tons of germs shoot up and coat everything nearby. "You've told me this," I say. "When she takes a shit, she started putting on a special t-shirt so that her regular clothes don't touch the back of the toilet. But is she, like, nestling against the lid? She's in the bathroom every morning way longer than I am, so maybe." "You've told me this," I say again. "Here's the thing. If you're an adult, whatever happens in there is between you and your God, right? But she fucking announces all this to me, and she's even given the shirt a name. It's her poop shirt. She hangs it on the back of the bathroom door next to our robes. This random pink t-shirt, and every time I see it, it's like she's rubbing my face in it."
"In the toilet germs?" I ask.
"In the disgustingness of her humanity. Does she want me to cheat?" It is 6:33 on a Friday morning in February, about 40 degrees and still dark. We're running east on Pershing toward Forest Park. On Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, I leave my apartment at 6:20 and get to Mark's house by 6:30. They live in a brick colonial, stately on the outside, cluttered and dog hair filled when you step in. And if he's already stretching in the driveway when I arrive, it usually means he awakened before his alarm went off and is in a bad mood. If I have to text him because he's still inside, maybe still asleep, it means he's equanimous. Occasionally, it even means he and Libby had sex the night before. "I doubt the shirt has anything to do with you," I say. "I think she's just existing," I add. "She doesn't want you to cheat, Mark." "Don't cheat." Though my brother is next to me and I'm not looking at his face, I know his exact expression as he mutters, "Said like a man who's never been married." It's while I'm parking in the garage adjacent to my law firm, I live in the suburb of Clayton and work in downtown St. Louis, that I feel in my pocket the ping of an incoming email. When I glance at the screen of my phone, I can see the first sentence, but I postpone reading the entire message. This way, an anticipatory pleasure, if I am being honest, the purest pleasure of my life these days, imbues the otherwise mundane 6 minutes it takes to ride the garage elevator to the lobby, cross the lobby to the other bank of elevators, and rise to the fifth floor, where I'm deposited at the glass entrance of Grant, Molyneux, and Molyneux. I greet Gloria at the front desk and my assistant, Rosemary, outside my office, set my briefcase on the desk, sit, and read the email on my phone. The phone's smaller screen feels more intimate than my computer. Like almost all the others, the message is one paragraph, with neither greeting nor sign-off. Rather, it ends with a YouTube link. Even as a child, I remember being enraptured by this piece. How the long orchestra statement of the first theme builds and builds in excitement, and then the violin and viola enter in octaves in a seemingly random moment. When I was younger, I thought it sounded like how flying would feel. And the second movement has to be some of Mozart's most beautiful and sad music ever. Apparently, he wrote it shortly after his mom died. The link is to Itzhak Perlman and Pinchas Zukerman playing the Sinfonia Concertante in E-flat major for violin, viola, and orchestra, conducted by Zubin Mehta. It was recorded in 1982 with the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra and is 25 minutes long, and I am 7 minutes in when I hear someone saying my name. "William?" It is Rosemary, standing at the threshold. "Richard Reinhardt from Brevetscher is holding for you?" "We went out for dinner on Saturday with the Kleins," Mark says. "One of those standard two-couple snooze fests. But primates are wired to socialize, right? Why fight it?"
It's Monday, and as it happens, I had dinner last night at Mark and Libby's, as I do most Sundays. I played basketball in the driveway with my nephews, who are 10 and 13, and after the meal, I was praised by Libby for loading the dishwasher, which Mark never does. But in the presence of his wife and children, Mark jokes around a lot and reveals little. As we make a left from Big Bend onto Forsyth, I ask, "Where'd you guys eat?" He says, "Parigi," a new, expensive place that serves French-Italian fusion. The four of us split a few bottles of wine. This detail catches my attention, but I say nothing, and Mark continues. We got home, I checked on the kids, and miracle of miracles, they were both asleep. I told Libby she looked nice. I start to kiss her, and she says, "Just so you know, there's a 0% chance we're having sex tonight." He laughs mirthlessly. 0%! She claimed she'd eaten too much, but I think she was pissed because I'd said at dinner that Sandra Bullock is annoying. I roll my eyes. "Sandra Bullock is America's sweetheart." "You sound like Libby," he shrugs. "I have opinions. Sue me." Maybe Libby had eaten too much. You know when I realized she'd given up on me? When she started preferring doggy style. That used to be like a present for special occasions. But she wanted missionary as our go-to, gazing into each other's eyes and all that crap. Now she's fine with me getting her off with my hand, then before I can even ask, she's on her knees with her ass in the air. And don't get me wrong, for sure it's efficient. But it's like, who's she picturing while I'm behind her? If you get her off with your hand, isn't it likelier that that's when she's picturing someone else? After a pause with a degree of fondness, Mark says, "Sometimes you're a real prick." When I turned 40, which was 16 months ago, I expected that the pressure to marry, the pressure exerted by others, would intensify. But to my surprise, it decreased. It turned out that simply by celebrating this particular birthday, I'd crossed some border of nonconformity. And while I still could, can, turn around, retrace my steps, and assume citizenship in the nation of wedlock, the expectation seems to be that I won't. I now hear, in reference to myself, the word bachelor. And though it evokes an image of a fussy gay man, and though I'm not gay and choose to believe I'm not fussy either, I don't mind. In fact, I'm relieved. I've dated plenty of women, nearly all of them intelligent and attractive, some exceptionally so. And I've never wanted to permanently attach my life to theirs. I've never even come close enough to be able to pretend to want it. That I understood our alliances to be temporary while the women were more optimistic was, as I progressed through my 30s, an increasingly keen source of pain. For the women, obviously, but for me too. In one case, at my girlfriend's behest, I read two books about men who fear commitment. But my feelings didn't change. My aversion to the prospect of a spouse and children was, apparently, anomalous enough that it needed an explanation, and I'm pretty sure this need was exacerbated by my appearance. I was average when younger. Like Mark, I have red hair, which has faded in intensity, and skin covered in ginger freckles. But just as the passage of time changed the meaning of my being single, it changed the value of my looks. And as the years passed without my putting on weight or losing much hair, I attained some higher status of desirability, enhanced, no doubt, by making partner at Grant Molyneux and Molyneux. That is, I've remained myself while my currency has increased. Mark, who at 43 is just under 2 years older than I am, got married when he was 26, the summer after he'd finished medical school. Libby had been his college girlfriend and worked in private school admissions until their first child was born, and she resumed that role when their second started kindergarten. That Mark's a pediatric cardiologist mostly offsets, to me, if not to everyone, how he's also kind of an asshole. Meanwhile, I consider myself morally neutral. I practice bankruptcy, restructuring, and creditors' rights law, and yes, I routinely represent clients widely agreed to be the bad guys. But I also do pro bono work, including teaching a quarterly financial literacy class at a nonprofit. So, a wash. Even as I resist the idea that my singleness requires more explanation than Mark's 17-year marriage, there was an explanation I offered to my girlfriends and happened to believe, disappointing as it is in both its succinctness and its banality. My parents had a bad divorce. The almost 2 additional years that Mark spent experiencing their marriage before it soured were, it seems, crucial in allowing him to later suspend disbelief about the institution. Or you could just chalk it up to our being different people. It's slightly less clear to me that I never wanted children than it is that I never wanted to marry. But I mostly didn't, and in any case, Finn and Noah charm me on Sunday evenings without leaving me regretful when I depart from their house. Mark and I are passing the baseball fields of Washington University when I say, "Seriously, though, I'm sure Libby hasn't given up on you." Mark says nothing, and I ask, "So was Parigi any good?"
"It was okay."
When I glance at him, Mark smirks.
"The food was a little rich."
"I like how slow and powerful this piece is," I write. "It amazes me how much emotion Chopin could fit into something that's only 4.5 minutes. You probably already know people called this sadness. Is it weird that Chopin and the Pixies remind me of each other? It's how they both move so quickly and effectively from loud to quiet." The link I attach is to Etude, Opus 10, Number 3. I text Bonnie at 6 while I'm still at the office. "Feel like company tonight?" Her response arrives less than a minute later. "Sorry, I have Sophia." Bonnie and I met 7 months ago, through a dating app, though dating is, of course, a euphemism. She lives 25 minutes south of me, is the manager of a houseware store, it's part of a national chain and hers is at a mall, and is divorced with a 9-year-old daughter I've never met. We see each other every 10 days or so, and though we went out for drinks a few times in the beginning, our encounters now occur exclusively inside my apartment or her condo, and start at around 8:30 p.m. with a glass of wine and a discussion of current events. We share few other frames of reference. After sex, she stays over, which I don't mind, but I never stay at her condo. I usually fall asleep, then wake at midnight or 1 and drive home. Bonnie is pretty enough. She's 38, with obviously dyed long black hair, and the curviest woman I've been involved with. She must outweigh me by 30 pounds, and I'm reminded, when she's straddling me, of the middle school girls who entered puberty before the boys did. The truth is that I consider her a kind of preventive medicine. If I could make my libido disappear, I would, and as I age, this might well happen. Certainly it's decreased already, but it hasn't yet gone away, and I've found in the past that I can go without sex for 3 or 4 months, and then one day I wake up in despair. Presumably, there are biological explanations, and my abrupt desperation has as much to do with touch as sex, meaning maybe I could stave it off with massages, of the more or less sordid varieties. I'm considering trying this after Bonnie tires of me, which I imagine will happen when she decides she wants a real relationship, a stepfather for her daughter. I will lament such a development and do nothing to stop it. "No worries," I text back. At 6:45, I leave the office, drive to Clayton, park outside my apartment building, and walk to a restaurant where, once or twice a week, I have dinner at the bar. The bartender, who is French and whose name is Thérèse, is the woman I currently am most attracted to. If she and Bonnie were standing side by side, Bonnie might not appear pretty enough after all. And if I were younger and knew less about myself, I'd pursue Therese. Even now, though I'm 15 years older than she is, I have a feeling she'd accept if I asked her out. She's unfailingly warm and has remarked more than once on how unusual it is that I pronounce her name correctly. Despite the 2 accent marks that appear on her name tag, apparently most St. Louisans pronounce it not only with a long second E, but also with a non-existent A on the end. I take my seat on a stool, and Thérèse smiles and says,
"William."
Ironically, she mispronounces my name. She says William, and I find it very endearing. I ask for a whiskey and soda, which Therese deposits in front of me with two skinny black straws and a curl of lemon rind. For dinner, I order green salad with wild salmon, and she says, in a teasing voice,
"Always so healthy."
"Not always," I say, though I do avoid bread and sugar. It's when I'm eating with others, most frequently with Mark's family, that I relent, more as a matter of politeness than indulgence.
"But you are not the only one,"
Therese says in her beguiling accent.
"I now train for a triathlon."
She holds up both her arms. Despite the chilly temperature outside, she is wearing a tight, sleeveless black top and flexes her biceps. "Impressive," I say. "When is it?"
"April. You run, yes?"
"I do run, with my brother."
"Maybe someday you and I run together."
She raises both eyebrows in the playful manner of a woman aware of how attractive she is. When it becomes clear that she's waiting for a response, I make sure to say it pleasantly. "Maybe so." She then turns to attend to a couple on another of the bar's three sides. There are only 12 seats around the bar, most empty on this Tuesday night. But instead of admiring her small, toned ass and graceful stance, as I usually would, I feel a dismal sorrow. She ruined it. It happened so quickly, but now it's finished. Though she asked me out with a casual deftness that allows us both to pretend she didn't, she did. And I'm certain that the intermittent rhythm of interacting with Therese while she's on the clock is far more enjoyable than her unbroken attention on a date would be. It's also true that if she were less fluent in English, I'd probably have asked her out weeks ago, in spite of everything. We could coast longer on each other's mystery. But the language barrier is negligible. If I did ask her out, I don't doubt that after the initial exuberance, I'd be quietly bored, politely restless, possibly subjected to reading yet another book about men who fear commitment. And Therese is young and lovely. She deserves better. It is, I assume, due to her confidence that she doesn't comprehend until after I've signed the check and am standing, that I'm not going to follow up on her overture. I won't try to confirm a day or time for us to run together, even tentatively. First, she's expectant, and then, as I say, "Have a good night," there is some shifting of her facial features, some new resentment and understanding. Back in my apartment, in bed beneath the covers, I imagine her naked on her knees. Her long hair is loose and swaying as her head bobs. But afterward, as I roll away from the wet spot to go to sleep, I know I won't return to her restaurant. "My favorite moment in all of Strauss's writing is the finale from Der Rosenkavalier," she writes. "His lush late romanticism mixed with dissonance makes it so evocative and thrilling, to the point that even though I've listened many times, it still almost brings me to tears. Okay, maybe not almost. This version is a trio, all sung by women. Amazing, no?" "Do you remember Alicia Thompson?" Mark asks. "My year in high school, tennis player, smoking hot body. Wasn't she prom queen?" "That's the one. So I ran into her yesterday in the elevator at the hospital. She was bringing her dad in for an echo. Let's just say, when it comes to looks, she peaked early." "Has she been in St. Louis all this time?" "She's married to a dude from Nashville, and I think they were there for a few years. Or Memphis? Anyway, back when she and I were seniors, she used to date Joe Streisman. Right after we graduate, they break up, and at a party at Tina Hoffer's house, Alicia and I end up alone in the basement. We've both been drinking, and she's full-on plastered and very touchy-feely. We're sitting really close together on this couch while she tells me about the breakup, all weepy and shit. Then she leans in and whispers right in my ear. Well, this is the eternal mystery. She whispers either, 'Hug me,' or 'Fuck me.' No kidding. It sounded like 'Fug me.'
Maybe she didn't know what she was asking for. Obviously, I should have just said, what? But here I am, 17 years old, with a rock-hard boner, and my logic is, if I hug her and she said, fuck me, I'll get another chance. But if she said, hug me, and I fuck her, I'm a rapist.
I take it you hugged her. Cheerfully, Mark says,
biggest mistake of my life.
When you guys were in the elevator yesterday, did you ask her which she'd said?
Sure, in front of her dad. Why not?
As we head south on Big Bend, he adds,
I want to be like the Clintons. I don't want to be like the Gores. I want to ball other women but stay married.
Anyone in particular?
There's this girl butcher at Whole Foods with a bunch of crazy tattoos.
What's that rule for how young is too young? It's half your age plus 7, right? So, if she's, what, 28, we're good to go. He pauses, then says slowly, I don't think she's 28. That ostensible rule means Therese needs to be 27, which she also isn't. But Mark knows about neither Therese nor Bonnie, and in any case, I don't anticipate crossing paths with Therese again. I say, aren't open marriages just a stopgap until divorce?
Oh, I don't want an open marriage.
Mark looks at me with distaste.
Where's the fun in that?
You don't want Libby to be involved with other men?
Of course not, he says. But even more than that, I don't want another domestic agreement, another fucking chore chart. I don't want to have a respectful dialogue about how we can both get our needs met.
Mark has been complaining about his marriage for a couple of years, during which time, as far as I know, he and Libby haven't gone to counseling, he hasn't cheated on her, and he's expressed his dissatisfaction to her barely, if at all. What he wants, it seems, is simply to vent, which is to say that perhaps he has been in counseling with an unaccredited therapist who happens to be me. Don't cheat on her, I say. From me. Do you know the story behind Symphonie Fantastique? Berlioz said it's about a man going insane because of how in love he is with a woman, which is so awesomely dark and dreary. The real autobiographical version is that Berlioz fell in love with an actress and wrote the piece to attract her. She eventually heard it, she married him, and they were miserable together. So if it's symphony as love letter, maybe that letter would have been better off left unanswered. After waiting 3 days, I text Bonnie again. You free? She usually responds right away, but this time, unprecedentedly, she doesn't respond at all. It is possible, of course, that she's traveling, or that she lost her phone, or that she's simply preoccupied. Just to be sure, I wait another day and text once more. Hope all is well. Again, there is silence. And it's not that I didn't know this eventuality was possible, not that I don't understand. It's not even that I care much that she's ghosted me. I just wouldn't have guessed it to be her method of choice. My favorite Berlioz is Harold in Italy, the viola concerto he wrote for Paganini, but Paganini rejected it because the viola part was too easy and not flashy enough. Then after hearing it, Paganini changed his mind. In addition to telling a story, it has weird phrase lengths, maybe related to Berlioz being a big user of drugs. My favorite part is the second movement, Marche des Pèlerins, March of the Pilgrims. The viola starts to play Ponticello arpeggios over the walking bass, and it's a series of chord changes with this special trance-like sound. The first time I went to Paris, I heard it in my head as I wandered around. Mark is standing in the driveway when I arrive, his legs spread, his torso tilted right, his left arm extended over his head.
You're not gonna fucking believe it, he says. Libby's preggers. Guess the old sperm have got some juice yet.
No, I think. But this is a visceral reaction, and selfish. It's not that I don't want another child for Mark and Libby, or, for that matter, a niece or another nephew. Amazing, I say aloud. 14-year age gap between our oldest and youngest kids. Mark holds his hand up for me to high-five and says,
No joke. This is going to be the baby that launches 1,000 vasectomies.
But you're happy? By which, of course, I mean, is this the point where we both start pretending you haven't spent the last few years confiding your adulterous fantasies?
Children are so life-affirming, Mark says. That moment when you bring home a newborn from the hospital, all tiny and wrapped in a blanket, you think, Jesus, everyone in the world was once this young, floating on a tide of parental love and hope.
That's before they turn into teenage assholes. It's hard not to wonder if it's really babies Mark loves, or if it's more that he's sentimental for the last time there were babies in his house, for when he was younger and his marriage was fresher. I am not, however, enough of a jerk to ask. I've been running in place, and when he joins me, we head east. He adds, besides, she's the one who'll have to get up for most of the night feedings. I knew already. She told me, via email, 2 months ago. She wrote,
so I'm pregnant. Not on purpose. Haven't told Mark. Yes, it's his, in case it seems like I'm implying otherwise. Not physically possible that it wouldn't be. Anyway, if I get through the first trimester, and it's very plausible I won't, given my age, you and I should stop emailing. FYI.
Wow, I replied. Congratulations?
A part of me always wanted a third, she wrote. But I didn't expect it to happen at this late date. You think you'll be excited or freaked out?
You'd know better than I would, I wrote back.
I wouldn't be so sure, she replied.
This was the first email about something other than music I'd received from her in 10 months. In the beginning, many emails were about other things, though music was their point of origin. I'd been at their house for a Sunday dinner, and Bach's Brandenburg Concerto No. 5 had been playing from a kitchen speaker as Libby pulled lasagna from the oven. I dressed the salad, and Finn set the table. I said, I've always loved this piece. And Libby said, did you know it's the first ever keyboard concerto? I shook my head, and she said, because there were no pianos back then, just harpsichords. Then, seamlessly, she turned and said, Finn, tell Dad and Noah to come in for dinner. She emailed me the next afternoon with a link to a version conducted by Claudio Abbado.
How great is the harpsichord cadenza in the first movement?
And I emailed back concurring and adding that I hadn't realized she was such a classical music buff, to which she replied that she'd played viola from the age of 7 to 18, that for years her dream had been to attend Juilliard, but that by the time she was in high school and entering competitions, it was clear she didn't have the talent, and she applied only to liberal arts colleges, not music schools.
You contain multitudes, I wrote.
Good to know. I better not try any classical music mansplaining. In the following 5 days, during which, as usual, I ran with Mark twice, didn't lay eyes on Libby, and didn't discuss her with Mark, my sister-in-law told me over email that for her sixth-grade living biography, she had been Bach, that she'd never enrolled either of her sons in music lessons because she'd ended up so conflicted about her own, but now she wondered if she'd made a mistake, and that the other day she hadn't been able to remember the word Q-tip and feared it was the first sign of early dementia. I told her that every year from 3rd to 7th grade, I'd dressed as a so-called hobo for Halloween, that in grade school I had wanted to play the trumpet, but my mother had said I could either play soccer or take trumpet lessons, but not both, and I'd worried Mark would think I was lame if I opted for an instrument, and that sometimes descending stairs I felt an intense, fleeting pain in my left knee that probably meant I wouldn't be able to keep running indefinitely, but for now I'd decided not to do anything about it. Somehow, this morphed into Libby describing the school meeting she'd just left, at which a colleague of hers had not only fallen asleep, but begun snoring audibly, and how Libby would definitely have awakened him if she'd been sitting closer, but she was 15 feet away and unsure of whether the very act of standing and approaching him was more disruptive than the snoring. And then the meeting ended before she could decide. I told her about a client from years ago
who always removed both his shoes and his socks when he came to my office, without comment, as if this were normal. And she told me how when Noah was in first grade, she was the mom in charge of buying pumpkins for the kids at Halloween, and the pumpkins she got from a farm over the Illinois border were so dirty she had to give all 50 of them a bath. She wrote, "Does this affirm your choice not to reproduce?" Smiley face. We exchanged these emails at all hours of the day, into the evening, and that weekend, on both Friday and Saturday, we sent about 15 each. We were debating what the best 1980s movie was, in terms of both quality and being most quintessentially 80s-ish. And at 11:15 on Saturday night, she wrote, "I'm falling asleep, so night-night, William." Where was my brother at that moment? In bed beside her? In another part of the house? Was she in bed? Honestly, at the time, I didn't wonder. Less than 24 hours later, when I went to their house for Sunday dinner, Libby and I didn't discuss the emails, and after I was back home, at 9:30 p.m., she wrote, "We can't do this anymore." I was genuinely surprised and wrote back, "Why? Are you serious?" Before I could confirm that I was, another message from her arrived. "Because I'm married to your brother." I considered not responding until the morning. I wanted a chance to collect my thoughts, but it occurred to me that she might interpret my silence as hurt feelings. "Libby, you're a wonderful person," I wrote. "I adore you. But there's nothing remotely romantic about any of this." She didn't reply for 45 minutes, which made me wonder if instead I'd hurt her feelings. Her response when it came, "If that's really what you think, I envy your ability to delude yourself." For the following week, we didn't communicate. It would be a lie to say I didn't miss her emails, to deny how quickly I'd embraced the existence of another consciousness with whom to exchange observations and experiences. And it would be a lie to claim I didn't feel some inner turmoil. But it wasn't the jilted person's turmoil. It was the uneasiness that accompanies a misunderstanding. On Sunday, I went to dinner at their house with trepidation, and I suspect Libby and I were both straining to behave normally, which mostly took the form of avoiding each other. Finn and I played about 30 rounds of horse in the driveway. That Wednesday morning at 10 o'clock, an email arrived, again sans greeting or sign-off. "I've thought about it, and I think you were right, and I was wrong, and it's fine for us to email, but let's keep it confined to music, nothing else." Driving to work this morning, I heard Gretzky's Symphony No. 3. Do you know that one? So beautiful and devastating. I never explicitly agreed to her terms. I simply complied with them. We exchanged 4 or 5 emails a day for 2 days. Then she wrote, "One more stipulation. We should only do this once a day. I'll email you between 8 a.m. and noon. You email me back between noon and 4. No weekends." "Okay," I wrote. This time it lasted nearly a year, with neither of us deviating from the schedule, including when she, Mark, and the kids went to Aruba for Thanksgiving with her extended family. And it wasn't that I hadn't known there were certain gaps in my life. It was that I wouldn't have expected the gaps to be filled by receiving and writing one email per day about classical music, or that confining the topic didn't actually feel that different from the brief stretch when we'd been telling anecdotes. In some encoded, albeit not erotic, way, confining the topic felt more personal. I'd still found another consciousness. I still could experience the anticipation and satisfaction of contact, the mental absorption of composing a response in my head before sending it. Being in touch with her offered a cushioning to my days, an antidote to the tedium and indignity of being a person, the lack of accountability of my adulthood. It gave me stamina with Bonnie and willpower with Therese. I thought I'd achieved an equilibrium, one so eccentric as to be incomprehensible to most married suburban couples, but for me, one that could last. It felt sustainable in a way none of my relationships with girlfriends ever had. "I hear Mark told you," her message reads. "Or told you. Since I've made it through the first trimester, we need to stop. I know I don't have a ton of credibility on this front, but I mean it this time. I'm tempted to say something like, take care of yourself, as if I'm writing in your high school yearbook, when obviously we're not saying goodbye for real, just goodbye to this version of things. It's 11 a.m., but if the correspondence is ending anyway, I doubt that I need to wait until noon to reply. Of course, I'll respect your wishes, I write. But are you sure? At the risk of stating the obvious, we could tell Mark we enjoy emailing each other about classical music, and I think he'd be okay with it. She writes back. Are you kidding? He'd be okay with it only insofar as he could mock us both. And then, and it wouldn't be fun if he knew about it, especially if he was okay with it. And then, when I said last year it was fine for us to keep emailing, I didn't mean it. To put it in legal terms for you, I was giving you the plausible deniability you seemed to need. Sure, marriages come in all shapes and sizes, but if one person is getting close to someone else, either both parts of the couple have to know and be on board, or else it's a betrayal. Or, to use another legal term, a lie of omission. And finally, the reason I pretended to think it was kosher when I didn't was that it had become too hard to get through the day without hearing from you. And the reason I restricted the times we emailed each other was that I was waiting all the time to hear back, which was unfair to my family and a fucked up way to live. It's not that I actually want to stop now, but there's too much at stake with a new baby. Mark and I need to be on the same team. It is physically difficult to read these sentences. Not for their conclusion, but for what comes before. Their implicit rebuke. Her distress. I have tried throughout my life to avoid upsetting women. Yet I have done so repeatedly. I consider being blunter than I ever have before. Blunt in a way I'd convinced myself was unnecessary with the sister-in-law I've known for over 20 years. I could write, I'm wired differently from most people. Call it my neurochemistry or call it my heart, but it doesn't work like yours. It doesn't feel what yours feels. My life would have been vastly easier if it did. If I express these sentiments, I know, because I've been through it before, that two outcomes are possible. The first is that she won't believe me, will cling to the idea of our being in love, and will plan to be the woman who's different from earlier women. She will think she can cure me. The second outcome is that she will believe me. She might initially call me names. I've been accused of being a tin man, of possessing a Frankenheart, of having a condition found in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, but in the end, what she'll feel is pity. I do not want to be cured by her, and I do not want her pity. I don't know what to say, yet it seems cruel to keep her waiting when she has made herself vulnerable. Thus I type, neither plausible deniability nor lie of omission is really a legal term. They're more like movie or TV versions of the law. Then I scroll through old messages, reread the one she wrote about Mozart's Sinfonia Concertante in E-flat major for violin, viola, and orchestra, and listen to the piece in its entirety while working on a brief. No message from her has arrived by the time the music concludes, but one comes in a minute later. Take care of yourself, William. It's early March now, meaning the sun is rising when I reach their house. The eastern sky is pale blue and tangerine. Mark is stretching in the driveway again, and when he catches sight of me, he says, Guillermo, my man! Salutations! You're in a good mood. Why wouldn't I be? He lifts his chin and nods at once toward the master bathroom window, which is above the front door. Look at that, he says.
queen of my heart, vessel of my progeny. Indeed, Libby is visible through the window. She's standing with her back to us, wearing a pink t-shirt. Is she about to sit on the toilet, or did she just finish? Oh, our private habits, our private selves. How strange we all are. How full of feelings, and essentially alone. Mark Wolf whistles. If it's an inconsiderate thing to do to the neighbors at this hour of the morning, it works. Libby turns and looks out the window. Hey, sweetie, Mark says. Though I doubt she can hear him, he's speaking at a normal conversational volume. She waves. But she is too far away for me to discern the expression on her face.
A regular couple. After dinner, on the first night of our honeymoon, Jason and I were sitting in the hotel bar playing cribbage when, from 30 or 40 feet away, I made eye contact with a woman who looked exactly like Ashley Fry. Jason was dealing the cards. Our travel version of cribbage comes in a zippered case with a miniature plastic board that unfolds and tiny pegs, and although the dorkiness of it makes me slightly self-conscious, it doesn't make me self-conscious enough not to break it out. And I said, "There's someone over there who's identical to a bitchy girl I went to high school with." Jason glanced over his shoulder. "Who?" "The blonde by the fireplace, but I'm sure it's not her." It was 2008. We were at the fanciest resort in a fancy western town, and I had graduated from high school in Cleveland in 1992. It's not that the area where I grew up wasn't nice. It was a suburb inhabited by families with dads who worked in law or finance, and even though my high school was public, it was cushier than a lot of private schools. But the hotel where Jason and I were staying was mostly a ski resort, and this was in July. Running into Ashley Fry in the off-season would have been odd, and besides, the woman who looked like her was with a man who was probably 15 years older, a little heavy, and generally too fatigued-seeming and unremarkable to be attached to Ashley Fry. "That girl was the queen of my high school," I said. "You were close friends, I assume?" Jason was smiling. "He knows what I was like as a teenager, flat-chested and stringy-haired, the daughter not of a banker but of a science teacher, and my husband appears to find it endearing, this vision of me as awkward and clueless, I think because he considers me so confident and strong-willed now. More than once, he said, 'You have bigger balls than I do.' If this is a compliment, obviously it's not one that most women hope to receive from their husbands." I put down a three of spades, then Jason played the three of hearts and said, "Six for a pair." "Maggie?" The Ashley Fry look-alike was standing beside our table, the older man slightly behind her. She laid her palm against her chest. "Maggie, it's Ashley from Clark High!" Her hair was a more honeyed blonde than it had been when we were teenagers. It looked expensively dyed, and she had the same ski-jumped nose and wide green eyes. She also had crow's feet, lines at the corners of her lips, and a certain haggard leanness through her face. She was definitely still pretty, but not like she'd been in high school. That pretty had seemed to guarantee whatever life she'd wanted, whatever boy. Whereas the pretty she was now was that of a well-groomed, mid-level professional. A pharmaceutical rep, perhaps. Nevertheless, I felt an old, visceral insecurity that manifested itself in an impulse to cover up our cribbage game with my hands. This was when Ashley said, "I'm sure you don't remember me, but I just said to my husband," this is my husband, Ed, "I said, 'Maggie will have no idea who I am, but I have to go over anyway. I know everyone must tell you this, but whenever we see you on TV, I'm like, I totally know her. That's what I say, right, Ed?'" She turned back to me. "Ed and I just got married. We're on our honeymoon." I hesitated, partly because I wasn't sure what to make of her effusiveness, and partly because, although Ashley didn't seem aware of it, I actually hadn't appeared on television in nearly 2 years. And Jason said, "What do you know? We're on our honeymoon, too." Ashley's mouth fell open with delight. "What are the chances?" she said. When Ed and I made our reservations, I thought, "This is such a weird time to come that I bet the whole resort will be a ghost town." I had imagined the same and been surprised when we checked in to find the lobby abuzz. Ashley extended her hand to Jason. "Ashley Horsford," she said. Glancing at me, she added, "That's what I go by now. Still getting used to the sound of it." Jason introduced himself and half stood to shake her hand, then Ed's, and I shook Ed's too. He made a one-syllable noise of acknowledgement, possibly something that wasn't an actual word. This was the husband of Ashley Fry? He was okay, not ugly, but there was nothing about him that made me remotely jealous. He was like a generic man I'd end up next to on the flight from O'Hare to LaGuardia. Hardly notice as I sat down, never really look at as I worked on my laptop during the flight, and not recognized by the time we reached the baggage claim. His face was broad and ruddy, and he was balding, with a few brown locks brushed back from his forehead and fuller hair along the sides. He wasn't fat, but he had that paunch you sometimes see on guys who were high school athletes and have spent the decade or two since then working a sedentary job and drinking a steady stream of alcohol. Another part of what made him seem older was that he was wearing a blue and white striped button-down shirt and a blazer, while Jason had on a long-sleeved t-shirt. We hadn't eaten dinner at the resort, but instead had walked to a pizza place in town about three-quarters of a mile away, and by the time we walked back, the temperature had fallen below 60 degrees. "When did you guys get here?" Ashley asked. "Just today," I said. "Oh, you'll love it. We got here. Ed, what day was it? I'm already losing track."
"Sunday," Ed said.
"Right, of course. We're staying Sunday to Sunday. How stressful is it having your whole wedding and then you're supposed to jump on a plane the next morning? We almost missed our flight." "Jason and I actually got married 4 months ago," I said. I felt a sort of hierarchical confusion about how to act toward Ashley. How nice or standoffish to be. If she hadn't started gushing so quickly, I'm sure I'd have been willing to take the deferential role. Old habits die hard. But clearly I now had the opportunity to present an aloof version of myself she'd never met. My confusion was different from the usual confusion I felt when approached in public, which almost never happened anymore. Back when it had happened, I couldn't be sure if the person was going to praise or attack me. The biggest clues, I'd realized over time, were age and gender. My peers, both male and female, tended to be like Ashley in thinking it was cool that they'd see me on TV, while women my mother's age were likelier to scold me, taking me to task for betraying feminism. The first time this had ever happened was at the gym near my office in downtown Chicago. It was a middle-aged woman, and I ended up talking to her for half an hour by the elliptical machines, defending myself. I went on a monologue about due process, and by the end of the conversation, I was very flushed, even though I hadn't yet started exercising. But I quickly realized that trying to explain my job, or the American legal system, served little purpose. Within a few weeks of that gym encounter, I stopped saying anything more to my critics than, "Obviously, you're entitled to your opinion." Then I'd walk away. "Be sure to take the cable car up Mount Majesty," Ashley was saying. "That was our favorite thing so far, right, Ed? Oh, and we're hiking to Moose Lake tomorrow, which is supposed to be amazing." Oh, Jesus, I thought, because that was what Jason and I had been planning, too. Then I thought we could easily go to Moose Lake on a different day. And then I heard Jason say, "We're going there tomorrow, too. It's clearly the place to be." I knew that if I made eye contact with him, it would be to glare. So instead, I looked at Ashley. "Well, I don't know what time you're taking off," she said, "but if you wanted to, we could all..." She giggled a little, and it was such a tentative sound that I almost felt sorry for her. But even then, I was conscious of feeling sorry not for Ashley Fry, but for Ashley Horsford. She added, "I mean, probably you guys want